digestible. I think you can kind of find a lot more really delicious flavors there, but it's a lot more work. Anyone who made sourdough bread during COVID knows that, like, yeah, it's a you gotta care and tend and do your stretch and folds, and that's why I had like people driving around with loaves of bread in their car going to pick up their kids from soccer so they could hit their timers. So either sourdough or some sort of commercial leavening. Lots of different options there too. But
these are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. This episode of the Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by DECKED. That's DECKED. If you don't know what that is, DECKED is a drawer system that goes in the bed of a pickup truck or a van, and it'll fit just about any American-made pickup truck or van. It's a flat surface on top, and then underneath there are two drawers that slide out that you can put your gear in, and it's going to be completely weatherproof, so I've never had snow or rain or anything get in there. There's also a bunch of organizational features like the deco line, and there's boxes that you can put rifles or bows or tools, all different sizes. There's some bags and toolkits. There's a bunch of different stuff that you can put in there. But the biggest thing is you can take the stuff that's in your back seat out of your back seat and store it in the drawer system, and it's secure. You can put a huge payload of a couple thousand pounds on top of this deck drawer system. There's tie downs on it, so you can strap down all your coolers and your four wheeler and whatever else you've got up there. It's good stuff. This is made out of all recycled material that's 100% manufactured in America. And if you go to decked.com/sixranch, you'll get free shipping on anything that you order. This show is possible because companies like DECKED sponsor it. And I would highly encourage you to support this American-made business and get yourself some good gear. How has having a child affected the way you cook at home?
I don't know. There's kind of like two parts. I think part of it has made it really functional. Sometimes, it's either like a treat. So like, oh, I'm going to go all out, make breakfast and pancakes and hash browns and do all the stuff. Or it's just like, for the love of God, just get this kid some mac and cheese.
Whatever's fast.
Yeah. Just cut the strawberry or just like make it happen. It is tricky. You find like you have to like make time for yourself then.
Yeah.
So, and like treating yourself to like a nice nutritious meal, because oftentimes it seems just like you're just trying to get the kid fed.
Right.
It's kind of like a new skill of learning to be intentional about, all right, I'm going to make the time, make a nice thing for myself included. Mm-hmm. But also just been really cool to watch her eat and grow and like try new stuff and like try to wipe the spicy off her tongue and just like, no. It's a really fun thing to watch. Or super into something one day and then just like throws it against the wall the next, and you're like, we'll keep trying.
Because how cool would it be to experience, you know, your favorite foods and flavors today for the first time?
Yeah, wild. And we're watching her do a lot of that. She's a good eater. It's like, yeah, it's been pretty fun. But what a wild thing.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, the girl could like literally live on cheese. I mean, I could too, but sometimes I'm like, we need to get you some variety.
Get a couple different colors up in here. Okay, what's the difference between a chef and a cook?
Cooks make food, chefs make cooks.
Okay.
I think, leadership and knowledge and training and
So is it more of like a student-teacher relationship?
I think so. Yeah, and also I think just what our country has done to chefs and media has done to chefs and things is not great.
Why? First of all, what? Like, what in your opinion has media and society done to chefs?
It's just a celebrity thing, right? I don't look at cooking or as being a chef as like a form of artistry like other people do. Mm-hmm. I really view it as a craft and like problem solving like a mechanic. I made a dish of fried thing that I wanted to be crispy with this dipper, and I pulled it out of the fryer and it wasn't crispy, so how do I change my batter to make things crispier? That's how I sort of look at food, and there's like creative moments in that of like these things go well together or this and that, but to me it's always like troubleshooting, problem solving. That doesn't taste good enough, how do I make this taste better? But I don't find it like I'm a painter with a canvas and it's like a me thing. Yeah. But I think a lot of the celebrity chef stuff looks like, look how great he is, or look how great they are, she is, whatever it is. They just put them on in this like pedestal, but it's like so much stuff happens. So there's like huge teams and
right.
It's such a team thing. Yeah. So when there's chefs make cooks, but then we're also like really doing the American glamorized celebrity, put him on a pedestal thing. It just thinks it does a lot of disservices to like, I don't know, chefs in general and like the rest of cooks. Yeah, I think also it kind of creates this like perfectionist mindset of that I don't think is attainable for like a lot of home cooks or people
right.
trying to like, you look on the internet for a recipe and it's the best XYZ, you know, it's
dude, internet recipes can go pound sand right now.
Yeah. They're terrible.
I am so upset. And I've talked with Adele about making a cookbook called Time and Temperature.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking for. Like, how long and how hot do I have to cook this thing?
Yep.
And then leave me alone for the rest of it. And I understand the business model because they're selling ad space. So the longer they can write this recipe and the more, you know, tertiary information that they can add to it that has nothing to do with the cook, the more blocks there are between paragraphs and the more ads they can sell that you'll scroll through and accidentally click on, that'll take you to another page.
Right.
When all you want to know is, how hot do I need to have my grill or my oven or my fryer, and how long does this thing have to be in there? And like, I'll spice it however I want to spice it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's just really created this one for money, obviously. Yeah. Ads, things, but to just like, so much about cooking is the process and screwing it up and taste it and try again and practice and like, well, that was all right, but next time I would do this. Well, then I think a lot of people don't give that a try the next time, you mm-hmm. know, like I'm a R&D like maniac. I'll make something 15 times and it drives everyone nuts around me before it's right. And that could be a pizza, a burger, a pancake, or whatever. I'll just dive down the rabbit hole and screw it up, screw it up, screw it up, screw it up, screw it up. And then I hit a good one. Great. Let's share it with the world. No one sees all that other stuff of right. like, yeah, the 15th smash burger you ate this week. 'Cause you're like, well, how do I get it to stick to the flat top in the right way? So you get the lacy thing. Is that too much salt or too blah, blah, blah? No one sees any of that stuff.
Right.
So, but that's what I want home cooks, I think, to do. And that's the fun part, is like really diving into stuff. But there's just now this like perfectionist mindset of, if I make this brownie, better be the greatest freaking brownie of all time. And it's like, what? No, it's like, screw it up. Try a couple different recipes. Like,
yeah. Death by comparison.
Yeah. Learn, eat.
And then when you're talking about that perfection side of the house, we're talking about matters of taste.
Totally.
Right? So what somebody might think is perfect, somebody else is going to think is trash.
Yeah.
And that's why it is definitely an area where perfection cannot be attained. Plating has gotten so wild.
Yeah.
And I see people all the time that look at a plate and they're like, oh, that's plated perfectly. That's plated beautifully. It's like, looks like you spilled sauce all over the place. Like, this is kind of chaotic.
Yeah.
Or it's so precise and, you know, you can tell somebody was in there with tweezers and wiping and
yep.
It's like, I don't want to touch this. Like, I'm going to break it as soon as I take a bite, you know? That's a little bit weird. And it's important. I should also say that I do think it's important because the first sense of food that people get, unless they're ordering fajitas in a Mexican restaurant, is looking at it.
Yeah.
Right? And that is important. And if it looks beautiful, then you're coming into it with a little bit better attitude, and the chances of it tasting good are better if you think that it's pretty on the plate.
Yeah.
So when you're taking something as humble as a smash burger,
yep.
Are you thinking very much about plating and, you know, if that burger's at the 6 o'clock position when it hits the table in front of somebody, or are you just throwing it out there?
No, not necessarily the 6 o'clock position. It's got to look good.
Yeah.
You know, people do. When it lands in front of you, yeah, it's got to look good. And there's no doubt that people do eat with their eyes first. That's just like a truth about food. I mean, all that other stuff I think has just gone way too far. It, for me personally, it's done a lot of important things for food. There's like a level of precision that I admire in those restaurants, and I worked in them for a long time to help gain my skills. And that sort of fine dining world cares so much. There's just so much care, attention, detail, push, all of these things just to try to make it the best you possibly can. But I don't want to eat there.
Yeah.
And like, I don't care if you plated it with your tweezers or if you like threw it from a slingshot like 60 yards away. It's like, I want it to make me feel good. And I think I'm just sort of at a phase of cooking in my life, and I'm sure kids did this too, of just wanting to make people feel good, and wanting me to feel good. And like, I want you to go, man, that was delicious. Thanks. Or the pat on the back and then walk out. I don't want it to be like, my senses are blown away and this was like a revolutionary artistic experience for me. Like, nah, I don't think that's for food.
I think that chefs and cooks are kind of a rung on the ladder. And they have to care about the whole ladder. So, you know, above them is the customer who's eating that food, who's going to pay them money so that they can keep going. But they also have to think about the business aspect of everything that they're doing and all the costs that are associated with creating that food. But furthermore, and increasingly, I see chefs caring about the ingredients and the sourcing of those ingredients and the people that are making all of the components of that food available and possible to you. It's wildly complicated to take something that arguably is artistry and add in the business element to it. Do you feel like you care the most about the business side of it, about the producers who are creating that food, about the consumers? How do you weight all of that?
Yeah, I feel pretty almost well-rounded at this point in my life with those things.
And what am I missing?
Oddly, like self-gratification.
Yeah.
Like the you component of, do I feel pride in this? Am I supporting the people I want to support, doing the good things I want to do? I started, really kind of cultivating relationships and creating relationships with farmers and that, and people growing and making food. And that definitely sparked like a new kind of wave of cooking for me, and probably the reason why I'm still here. I had a conversation with your mom about it actually, and she put it the best. She was like, you're the flashlight. So there's all these people behind the scenes that are doing, making food, making things, making products, and chefs are just like a great flashlight to the public of all of these other places. In Portland, when there was like so much more like of these relationships, more small farms, cheese purveyors, all these things, I felt like a drug dealer. It was like, I got all the goods, and right. I know what all the good stuff is, and now I'm just trying to get that to the people and in a way that's fun and approachable and makes people feel good.
Yeah.
So there's definitely that part, and I would say that part's the driving force for sure. And then also teaching people, I mean, a lot of teaching people how to eat, teaching people how to cook, teaching people how to eat with seasons. And a lot of people haven't had like something that tastes good, and asparagus that tastes good. You eat the stuff out of a can your whole life. And I think there's ways to make those things really delicious. So I really like the aha moments where I would never put asparagus on a pizza. I would never add this to that or beets with this. Those sort of like new introductory things are pretty important to me.
One of the things that I'm concerned about within agriculture, especially in like human food production, that side of the ag house, is people expect to be able to, in North America, eat a fresh tomato anytime they want.
Right.
And in order to do that, we are lifting some heavy weights.
Huge.
And the end result is they're eating the idea of a fresh tomato, whereas that thing was picked green, potentially in another country.
Yeah.
And the reason that it was picked like that is so that it could survive the trip, gets gassed with ethanol in order to turn it red by the time it gets to you.
Yep.
Is close to flavorless unless you add something to it.
Yep.
So there's a good chance that you're just buying red Mexican water so that you can have the idea of a tomato in January in Northeast Oregon.
Yep.
That's bonkers.
It's bonkers. And the tomato is one of like the thousands of examples where that happens. Yeah. Could create a whole podcast about why America's food systems are wonky. But I think I've just sort of found my place in, I used to be kind of like activist-y about it and preachy. It drove my sister nuts. It was like, are you buying organic? And blah, blah, blah. You get a little older, have a kid. Now it's do the best you can, you know, and support.
Idealism dies with age.
Yeah.
It doesn't pass the endurance test.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And yeah, do the best you can. And every now and then try something new and make a new recipe. And every now and then stop by the farmer's market and buy a thing from somebody who's growing something. And just try to put that in your rotation. And I think the rewards are pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder in colder climates when the first vegetarians started to occur.
Yeah, sure, it had something to do with global supply chains and...
It had to have been fairly recently.
Access,
yeah,
right?
If we think about history, because, you know, we do have the ability to preserve fruits and vegetables, but it's not great, and it hasn't always been great.
Yeah.
And our preservation methods are dependent upon materials that, for the most part, are relatively modern, if we're talking about jars and cans and things along those lines. Beyond that, you're probably, you know, drying herbs, maybe drying some roots, some things that you could put in like a hole in the ground and would survive for a few months.
Yep.
But, you know, fat and meat, those have to be the wintertime foods of colder climates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and the work you did in the summer.
Right.
You better put it up or you don't got much.
Right.
And then I'm sure once we suddenly had access to growing seasons year round, then of course we'll take the convenience.
Sure. 'Cause
that's how it goes.
It's interesting. What is the most successful recipe in the world?
I don't know, but I'm sure it's got mayonnaise in it. great question. I don't know. grandma's.
What comes to mind for me is like hamburger, macaroni and cheese, pizza.
Yeah, in America for sure.
Yeah. The hamburgers crushed it. Like you can go most places and get a hamburger.
Gosh, the hamburger crushed it. Yeah. I mean, tacos also.
There's a million pizza restaurants.
A million pizza restaurants. Yep.
Is that the most common restaurant theme in America?
I don't actually know, but it feels like it. Burgers, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right. Can't go to any. Most menus just in general have a burger.
Yeah.
Yeah, pizza, I'm sure, is up there.
Hamburger is a really efficient use of the protein.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah, it works on all levels. It's like pretty minimal prep. It also has like, even with fast food, has like decent price perception from the public. So there's just like a wide range. People will pay $25 for a burger and $3.95 for a burger.
Yeah.
And feel okay. That part gets really tricky, especially with things being so expensive right now. It's like there's so much stuck price perception on these like certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, if you start pushing $15-16 for a sandwich, people scoff.
Right.
It should probably cost $26 sometimes, you know, but it doesn't. Yeah. And pizzas too. You start pushing these price points and yeah, it's just not really palatable anymore. But for whatever reason, burgers is like, there's a sweet spot, of course, but
right.
Big range.
Yeah. You can still get an $8 burger in Wallowa County.
Yeah.
That is not fast food. And I think that that's amazing. There can't be a lot of that left.
No, there's not a lot of that left. And also maybe, even just in the last few years working in restaurants, it's like, man, things are expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's made a tricky business real tricky.
Yeah.
And I think often have to ask like a lot of hard questions and something's got to give.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some of those hard questions?
For me, who cares about sourcing? It might just not be using the nicest things all the time, so you can pay your staff well. But you can't have everything now. You can't pay your staff extremely well and buy all of these nice things and pay your rent on this place and bills and blah, 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 and be in a price perception that makes sense to people. Mm-hmm. I feel like you used to be able to either do that or get close. But now I feel like it's pretty unattainable and one of those things has to like have some wiggle room. Hope you got cheap rent or maybe it's highlighting a product and then using some of these secondary things that are a little more affordable or simplifying how many things are actually on the plate or charging a few bucks extra and hoping people are into it.
And
it's pretty tricky right now to find that balance.
Yeah. And it's a notoriously tough business model. Like restaurants fail all the time.
Yeah.
You started from scratch a successful restaurant in a place that has seasonal customers for the most part during COVID.
Yeah. Such a bad idea. I mean, it was a great idea, but look, in hindsight, a lot of the things we were up against, naiveness really, really was a powerful tool. Climbed through a lot, for sure, and felt very lucky. We were very supported by the community, sometimes not, but mostly supported by the community. And the people who showed up like they wanted us to be there.
Right.
Yeah, never forget that. That was pretty cool. Even deep times during COVID, it's like, I got pizza in the freezer. I got pizza in the fridge. I gave my friends 2 pizzas, but we want you to make it.
Yeah.
So bought 2 more pizzas and took it home. They're like, I actually am sick of your pizza. We don't even want any more. But just showing up to, because that's what you do.
Are you still passionate about pizza?
Yeah, I don't know why. It got me.
Let's talk about pizza.
Cool.
Where does it start?
It's all the dough.
The dough.
It's only the dough.
It's only the dough.
The other stuff is also important, but we'll call it 90% the dough.
Okay. Well, let's talk about pizza dough.
Let's talk about pizza dough. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of like straddle. I'm never a good baker. I'm like too fidgety or like not precise enough. So pizza sort of straddles this line between like baking and something that's alive, but also you get to like enter into the savory world.
Yeah.
Yeah, pizza dough. I don't know. It's just like infinite and you never win. So it's got kind of always this like thing you come back to and try to make it better and better and tweak and fix.
What kind of flour do you use?
Lots, and I've tried lots of different things. I think pizza that people visualize in their head and still is pizza is often mostly like an AP white flour or bread flour mix. Definitely experimented with whole grains in there. And I think there's a range in which that's really fun. And then you start to get into this range of where like you put a bunch of whole grains in my pizza. Yeah. So finding that line's been fun, and I'm always an advocate for whole grains and trying to incorporate that into people's rotation.
Why?
Number one, I think it's delicious and also got a bad rap. There's a lot of really gross whole grain breads. And I think that was people's introduction oftentimes to whole grains and things. But yeah, there's a lot of things. Grows really well in our climate. You can eat really, there's really amazing producers of grains in Oregon. Mm-hmm. A lot of that actually matches climates in Japan. So you get some of the world's best buckwheat in Oregon, which is pretty cool for that someone would make soba with. So there's that. You can eat really regionally and locally and Pacific Northwest-y. They're also just, yeah, very delicious, very fun, very diverse. White flour is going to taste like white flour 100% of the time. Spelt rye and a lot of these other whole grains are just really unique and have, I don't know, yeah, more fun to me.
I think about domestication quite a bit, because I live in this world that straddles what's left of wild and wilderness and ranching and agriculture, mm-hmm. right? Those are the two continents that I stand on most of the time. And I watch these species as they become domesticated. And I've talked about this with bears recently, because I think that bears in a lot of ways are on the verge of domestication, right? We've got bears that are dependent upon people for food, and that's a great start. I think that's probably how it started with wolves.
Yep.
And, you know, you had wolves that were probably following hunters and getting the leftovers, and then they may have lost the skill to hunt on their own and started hanging around the camps more, and then got comfortable enough that they got put to work. And then, you know, we took that and then started selecting for specific traits. And pretty soon you have all the species and breeds of dogs in the world today. Really, yeah. Remarkable thing.
Crazy.
Mustelids being the weasel family. So like river otters, wolverines, badgers, weasels. They're one that has my eye right now. Hmm. They're incredibly, incredibly intelligent. And I've got a river otter skull up here on the far right, and his brain compared to the size of the rest of his skull and body is much larger than any other skull in this room, or actually any other skull that I've ever encountered. So that brain size is absolutely massive. And then we got to start looking at what these animals are doing. So we've got honey badgers that are using tools that are solving complex problems.
Yeah.
We have sea otters that are taking a rock, diving down to the bottom, picking up a mollusk, and then using that rock to open it.
Yeah.
And we look at that and we go, oh, cute. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I look at that and say, that animal is in its stone age right now. And that was us not very long ago.
Yeah.
Right? They're using tools. They're creating tools. They're problem solving. Like, this is an animal that's progressing really rapidly.
Yeah.
I come back to wheat.
Yeah.
I think that wheat could make an argument, if it could talk, that wheat has domesticated humans more so than humans domesticated wheat. It is one of the most successful plant species in the world because humans became dependent upon wheat. So now everywhere that we are, so is wheat.
Yep.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. But instead of us being open to all of the breeds of dogs, we've really narrowed it down to just a few sort of workhorse varieties of wheat.
Sure.
I would encourage people to just to branch out every now and then. But it's also hard because you go to the supermarket and you don't have this like vast array of things anymore. You have two or three.
Why is flour packaged in the least convenient way?
I don't know.
I feel like we need to do better than like an ultra thin paper bag that's definitely going to fail before you're done with that flour.
Yeah, open it outside. I don't know. you'll make a mess. That's part of the fun.
Okay, so pizza dough.
Pizza dough.
We've got flour. You like to mix and match a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How important is the quality of the water?
I think a myth. Not nerdy enough to know all of the ins and outs. I'm sure there's some properties in certain waters that do certain things in breads, but I would say for the most part, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that includes the like New York water bagel pizza thing. There's been a few studies and a few articles that are like, well, actually, I don't think any of that's true. Maybe a little bit, but not going to affect too much.
Yeast,
yeah. And endless rabbit hole there. So big fan of sourdough and naturally leavened things. Mm-hmm. Kind of feels like you're just making magic in your kitchen from the air, which is pretty cool. Easily digestible. I think you can kind of find a lot more really delicious flavors there, but it's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anyone who made sourdough bread during COVID knows that you gotta care and tend and do your stretch and folds. And that's why you had like people driving around with loaves of bread in their car going to pick up their kids from soccer so they could hit their timers. So either sourdough or some sort of commercial leavening, lots of different options there too. But honestly, I usually lean towards the sourdough and naturally leavened thing, but there's really great pizza makers using kind of the whole spectrum of things.
Sourdough is something that occurs all over the world, but the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, that's something that we can kind of hang our hat on. Sourdough is one of our foods that I think that we can claim, and there aren't a ton of them that we can.
Yeah,
but I think sourdough is definitely one of them. It does some interesting things. Tends to lower the glycemic index of your entire meal.
Yep.
Which acts differently from other bread. Lactobacillus, which is one of the things that makes sourdough naturally leaven, occurs in breast milk.
Yeah.
Right? This is a bacillus that is so important that if babies don't have it, they die.
Yeah.
Right?
It's wild.
So it's an interesting part of being a human. And then to be able to use that in bread later on in life, pretty interesting, pretty cool.
Very interesting. Yeah. And I think it, from like a cook's perspective, yeah, it can be one of those like lifelong things of where like you never win. So
sure,
you're always trying to tweak, improve, or you do everything right and it just goes wrong. Yeah. And we had several days like that at our shop where it was like, well, that just sucks today and I don't know why. Or it's perfect today and I don't know why either. So
Well, there's a lot of fuss that gets made about old sourdough starters that have been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And I have a little bit of a problem with that, even though there are generational sourdoughs in my family that are very old.
Yeah.
But a sourdough is constantly evolving because it's always getting whatever yeast and bacteria are in the air, and it's changing. It's changing with the current conditions that you're in.
Yeah, and whatever you just fed it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure how much, similar to the water, I'm not sure how much validity there is to this has been in my family for 200 years, other than the fact that, wow, that's really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, you were able to span generations of, like, consistently loving and caring for this organism that fed you back.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really amazing thing. That said, I don't know if I put as high of a food value on old sourdough starters as some people do.
Yeah. Neither do I. But I'm very happy for them.
Yeah.
Because I kill them all the time.
Well, you can just make a new one.
You can just make a new one. Yeah. I usually borrow them from a buddy and, yeah. But, yeah, good on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got...
what else goes in there? A little bit of salt, maybe?
A lot of bit of salt, probably more than people think. Usually in, like, the 2.5 to 3% range, which is, like, sausage salt. So, yeah, salt and then oil or some sort of fat, typically.
Are you nerdy about salt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we're not talking about table salt.
No, I have, yeah, brand loyalty.
Do you?
Yeah.
What's your brand?
Diamond Kosher.
Yeah.
Diamond Crystal Kosher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of kosher salt.
Yeah, definitely kosher. I usually stay away from, like, iodized table salts or the fine stuff.
Yeah. Morton's kosher salt is what I use the most for meat and dry aging and all that goofy stuff that I do.
Yeah, Morton's is good. It's got huge flakes.
Huge.
Yeah.
They're monsters.
So for steaks and grilling and smoking, and it's pretty fun because you get just these like big crunchy salty bites. Mm-hmm. Oil, salt, water.
We can't yeast. Just gloss over oil.
Yeah, so that can kind of span into, like, also butter. So just sort of fats in general.
Do you use butter in pizza dough?
Pizza Hut. Yeah, one of, like, the OG pan pizzas from Pizza Hut is a butter crust.
Really?
Yeah. They're very good.
Nobody out pizzas the hut.
Nobody out pizzas the hut. Butter crusts are kind of catching on a little bit in, like, the pizza trendy world. But yeah, typically olive oil. A lot of times it's like cheap canola olive oil blends that you'll find in pizzerias just because they're more affordable and you use a lot. But yeah, same also a lot. So it can kind of range from like the 2 to 6% range of like your total flour weight. So sometimes that's a lot of oil.
A lot of oil, a lot of salt.
A lot of oil, a lot of salt.
What else goes in pizza dough?
For me, that's what I stick to. Flour, yeast, salt, oil, water.
Now, your restaurant was wood-fired.
Yep.
And you were using local wood, which it probably isn't that traditional to use conifers for wood-fired pizza, I wouldn't think. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, definitely not. And we went away from that real quick because it didn't work.
Just too much creosote.
Too much creosote, also spitting, so you'll get a crackle that'll just fire an ember onto somebody's pizza.
Yep.
And just like temps, like hardwoods just burn so hot and like coal retention and hardwoods are just the tool. So
there's more BTUs in there, more calories.
More calories. Use less, burns hotter. Yeah, all the wins. So we ended up getting oak from somewhere in a supplier in Seattle that people shipped to the county for us.
Nice.
Yeah, it was not this, not ideal. It was like, well, where do you get your wood? It was like, well, we're trying. yeah, I know anyone who's got some hardwoods. Like, well, there's a guy with an apple tree in Omaha.
Yeah.
If you want to work all day for a couple branches.
Right.
So that ended up being pretty tricky, actually. But, yeah, found something that ended up working.
How hot did you like to get that?
Yeah, we baked in, like, the 730, 750 range.
So what's a home cook to do? Because we can't get our ovens that hot. We can't get a grill that hot.
Yeah. Pizza stones.
Yeah.
A couple of them usually helps with heat and heat retention.
Okay. So you've just got a little bit more thermal inertia going through that ceramic.
Yep. And as hot as it can go.
Yeah.
Then you can still make some pretty good pizza, but yeah, restaurants have the tools.
Right.
That's why it's better.
Yeah. So if you're, you know, 700 degrees plus, how long does it take once you throw that pizza in there?
Those took about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where I'm at now, we're at like the 575 range, which is honestly pretty close to a home oven. Mm-hmm. And they take about 6 minutes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty significant difference for, yeah. That's interesting. Do you wish it could get hotter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working on it.
Yeah. Trying. Add some more fuego.
Trying. Yeah. Need a different tool, but this one's working out great.
I think you're making great pizza.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying.
Yeah. Okay. I think sauce is important.
It is, but it's only in the 10%.
10%?
It's only in that 10%. 90's the dough.
See, it's a deal breaker for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's all important.
Yeah. I could have good sauce on a saltine cracker rather than crappy sauce on a beautiful Ross Effinger wood-fired pizza crust.
Sure. What's crappy sauce to you?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. That's complicated.
Yeah, it's just icky.
Like ketchup, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe too sweet then?
Yeah, maybe too sweet or just lacking complexity.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sauce does something interesting there that, yeah, and then is it like soaking down into that dough?
Or it gets soggy. And
yeah.
Yeah.
That's not great.
Nobody likes that.
Cheese is important.
I mean, it is all important, but if you have all of these other good things on top of shitty pizza dough, can I cuss on you?
Yeah. You just got to know that Grandma Janie's listening.
Okay. Sorry, Grandma. Yeah, if you have all these other things on top of bad pizza dough, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's all important. And that's why it's fun. All the little details add up, and there's, like, all the nuance adds up. You could do everything correctly and underbake it. But if it's just a little underbaked, then it's not crispy or, like, it's all floppy or the crust doesn't taste very good or this or that. So, yeah, it's all the nuances, all the work, all the little things, and they all culminate to like just a little simple pizza. But for whatever reason, yeah, it got me, and I dove deep.
Cupped or flat pepperoni?
Oh, I like both, but truly nothing makes me happier than a bunch of tiny little cupped pepperoni. It just sparks joy. It's like, how do you not like it? They're awesome. But I still like the OG flat ones.
Yeah.
Them.
Are they I don't understand, because I haven't deep dove this, how to make cupped pepperoni. I imagine it's the sausage casing.
A lot of it has to do in the casing. Yeah, I'm honestly not quite sure. I'm sure moisture contents in there is probably one, just like how it reacts with the heat and what it does. The size of it, I'm sure, too. But yeah, they've really engineered the shit out of pepperoni. You can buy, like, this one is this size, lays flat. This one is this size and reacts this way in an oven at these temperatures. This, full food engineering there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Options. Lots of options.
It's fascinating stuff.
It really is. What we've done with food and created is, like, pretty wild. There's very, very smart people putting a lot of time and energy into making things just the way you want them.
What's the frontier of food right now?
Ooh.
Or cooking.
Yeah. Frontier meaning what? Like
what's the leading edge?
the
like what's the wild place that we're just starting to explore?
I don't know, but I mean you get all these like farm to table taglines and you get all of these fresh, like just all these like buzzwords, right? Mm-hmm. I just really hope all of that trickles down to just people, trying something new, caring, putting like a little more, what if I try this, into their cooking. I mean, chefs and creative restaurants and that will sort of always be pushing this into like new territories, right? The molecular gastronomy phase like changed everything.
That was really interesting.
Super interesting. Changed food forever. And we see that trickle down in like from like corner bistros to fast food, which is pretty wild.
And let's talk about what that is for a little bit. My understanding is that it was a study of how the chemistry of that food is actually making people feel. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think more so like introducing chemistry into what we can do with food, which industrial food makers had already been doing, but we were sort of blind to it in a sense, and then took it to like just a more general level. But yeah, now you see like foams and IS, those like CO2 canisters in every restaurant, you know, encapsulating something in a gel or sphere of, to me that always, I'm very rooted in like what's real for food. So that's why I like working with ranchers, farmers. Like it's very tangible for me. I saw this come out of the ground from people who worked hard. Now I get to cook it and serve it to restaurants or serve it to customers. But that to me is like, doesn't follow any of those like linear processes. The effect that it has on just sort of like the food and food culture in general is pretty vast. Would love to see it go in some, I hope those chefs and I hope chefs in general realize that they do have that sort of power, like that influence. Try to use that in good ways.
Influence to do what?
Influence to influence people's behavior and eating. And I hope that after somebody was like, man, I never had asparagus on a pizza before, they go buy a bunch of asparagus and cook it at home. That sort of influence. Kind of continuing the education about food. But chefs do really play a pretty pivotal role in that, of sort of like changing that landscape, which is a good amount of power. So use it for good.
What's the best food city in America?
Oh, great question. Probably New York. I mean, definitely New York. But I just kind of love being surprised anywhere you go. I lived on the East Coast for a little while. New Haven, mm-hmm. Connecticut, just got this like bonkers little super specialized pizza scene. I just think stuff like that is so fun. Like, rip through the South and have some barbecue and be like, where am I supposed to go? And you open a back door and there's a guy in a smoker and paper plates and the place is a mess and that just like blows your lights off. Those are the things that I like the most. But if I had 72 hours to romp around anywhere and just eat till I threw up, New York's the way.
I'm going New Orleans.
Yeah?
I can't get enough.
Yeah, the Cajun bug really bit you, huh?
Dude, it did.
I know.
Because it was the first time that I'd ever been able to enjoy spicy food.
I know, I still don't understand.
I don't either.
Because it's typically just like cayennes and like powdered peppers in Cajun foods.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you've had a million times in your life and said, I don't like that.
Right.
But for whatever reason, like with everything else or I don't know. Maybe it was circumstantial.
Could be. I think looking back on it, it's probably the amount of fat that's in those dishes.
Yeah.
And using fat to carry that heat instead of an acid.
Yep.
You know, that might be it, but I don't know. What I do know is it was just a tremendous eating experience.
That's cool.
And it was so fun, man. Yeah. It's so fun. And that's definitely a place that has DNA in their food.
Like, yeah, without mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Or with less mayonnaise.
Right.
Yeah, so much DNA. Yeah, like real culture and like real DNA.
Yeah. Besides sourdough, what do you feel like are some foods that, you know, our region can claim as their own?
Fruit do great with, yeah, like the Fruit Loop on Mount Hood and apples and,
yeah, we're great at cherries, apples, pears.
Yeah. That's definitely a fun one in the Pacific Northwest. Fish and
salmon,
the Oregon coast. Sadly, lots of it flies to Japan because they know better than us, I think. But yeah, really, really cool things to eat out of the ocean in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely an annual trip for us. Dungeness crab.
Yeah.
Like if there was, a meal forever, the rest of my life.
It'd be Dungies?
Yeah, steamed Dungeness crab and a cold beer. That's up there for sure.
Steamed?
Yeah, steamed.
See, I'm team boiled in seawater.
Yeah, I see that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think steaming can be in salty water or with salty water.
Yeah.
Can be a little gentle, more gentle.
Sure. A little bit more precise, probably.
Yeah, but same end result, similar end result.
Yeah. Just better.
Have you ever been to Kelly's Brighton Marina?
Where's
on
that?
The Oregon coast? I honestly forget. Yeah. I just know how to get there.
Yeah.
Near Tillamook.
Okay.
But within like a, I don't know, 25 minute drive or so.
Northern coast somewhere.
Yeah. But they, from what I can tell, they have pumps that pump seawater into a big kettle.
Mm-hmm.
You show up and you pick a live crab.
Yeah.
Dunk it into the kettle for too long, but still fine.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they've got like a little shop where you can go get a lemon and microwave your butter and then just sit outside and crack open a crab and it's a joy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a real good one.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty honky tonk. and a really wily place. One of those backdoor situations. You'd be like, are you sure I was supposed to come here? But it's a fun one.
Dungies are kind of a cool crab. There's a lot of meat in them.
Yep.
They're pretty slow. They're relatively easy to handle from the fishing standpoint, you know, up until it's getting in hot water. When I lived in North Carolina, I was right on the salt, so I could throw crab pots out and literally have them tied up to, you know, cleats in my yard.
Yeah.
And whenever I had buddies come out from Oregon, it was a fun game for me to catch some crabs and then have them help me grab them and stuff.
Yeah.
Because those blue crabs are ninjas. Yeah. They are so fast. They're so strong, and they're like a leopard. They'll just get you 17 times before you know what's happening.
Right.
And inevitably, the Oregon guys are used to grabbing big, slow Dungies and reach out to and grab a ninja blue crab. Like, ta-ta-ta.
Yeah.
And they're a delicious crab. I was actually just talking with Hannah Mabbitt about this the other day about ranking the crabs of North America. I think stone crab claw, you know, as far as a bite is pretty special. King crab, of course, is incredible.
Yep.
Blue crabs are phenomenal. Dungies are great. Snow crab, good. Yeah, snow barred eyes, good. But it's probably not going to be at the top of anybody's list.
Yeah. There's some other, like, lesser-known ones in Oregon that are pretty cool. Rock crabs that, like, really sort of – they look like little bulldozers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty, pretty special to, live near the ocean.
Yeah.
Even though we're far, it's like still accessible.
Right. We can get there in a day.
We can get there in a day. It's a bad day, but you can still get there.
It can be done.
And then we get to drive back home. And that's the best part.
Man, you grew up in Alaska playing hockey.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like a natural progression to becoming a reluctantly celebrated chef in Oregon.
Reluctantly.
Because you are celebrated. People love you. They love the food that you produce. You're in high demand.
Thanks.
You can go wherever you want. And I think that says, this speaks volume to like who you are as a person and in your methods and all that R&D and caring about every aspect of the game, right? You care about your business and your employees and your customer and the sourcing of your food. Like you're exactly the type of chef that should be celebrated, in my opinion, whether you like that or not.
I don't, but thank you.
Yeah. So how did that happen?
Born and raised in at the end of a valley, at the end of a road, in a place that looked pretty similar to here. My dad came out to visit when we first moved here. He was like, "What in the world? Like, you moved home, just somewhere different."
Yeah. To the Alaska of Oregon.
Yeah. Just grew up in a really rugged place. Like, bears ripped apart our chicken coop and moose eating your crab apples out of your yard and throwing rocks at them, and really, really long, very cold winters and very dark. Skating on frozen ponds and just like being outside. So I think that definitely sparked like a love of outside and things that grow.
Yeah.
Definitely. A love of hockey, for sure. Definitely dove deep into that for a long time. And then I think the punishment that comes with hockey is maybe good training for restaurants sometimes. Yeah. They're very similar, sports and cooking professionally, I think. So a lot of people I've met through the years are like, "Oh, yeah, well, I used to race bikes," or, almost went pro with volleyball, or you just sort of attract this group of people who thinks really quickly, works really hard,
and is willing to accept and identify failure and try again.
The love of practice. I think I would just stand outside and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot until it felt easier. So I think that definitely instilled that burger wasn't right, so make another one.
Right.
Do it again till it is right.
And within that mentality, people who are successful, they go and not until they can hit, but they go until they don't miss.
Yeah.
And once they're at that stage, it's like, all right, now we'll take this skill and we'll put it into use.
Yep.
But not until then.
Right. It's a bit obsessive for sure, but I think, hockey, I think, was pretty paramount in kind of creating that in my brain anyway. But I think Alaska sort of just sparked like the awe of the big outdoors, and then my dad, he was like a backcountry skier, hippie, climber, race sailboats. So it was always about like being outside and appreciating it. He wasn't a hunter, taught myself how to fish. We went fishing a few times, but that was never like his focus up there. I think it was kind of surprising to some people who are like, "Well, I moved to Alaska County and I don't know how to hunt actually." Yeah. From Alaska, are you kidding me? That was just never the focus. It was just about going outside and going on a ski and just being outdoors and appreciating that. So, that definitely carried into my 20s and just was like your backcountry rock climber guy for a little while. And then, found kitchens and kind of was like, oh man, there's other people who like this psycho, fast-paced, really hot, sharp knife thing. Great. I want to be their friend.
How do you, as like a, you know, gentle person, deal with some of the abuses that occur in kitchens as you're coming up through it?
Yeah. A friend of mine used the phrase shut up and color recently, which is really not great. But I think I'm good at that.
Yeah.
When I need to be. And then when I got old enough to manage own teams and got put in a position of leadership, that's just like a vow to try to change the culture of all of those things. Like, yeah. You can say the words and not be a dick. Yeah. And you can treat people with respect and be firm about your expectations. Yeah. And mostly, like, the first thing I say to new hires often is, hey, just want you to know, we'll have a lot of conversations about that feel like a critique, or this needs to improve, or that's not correct, or we do that this way here. But just want you to know that that's never personal. It's not about you, actually, at all. It's always about the food, always about the end result, always about the product going out. And I wish there was more of that in kitchens and kitchen culture. Yeah. Not to say that a couple a-holes ruined it, but like a lot of a-holes ruined it. It just became this sort of like machismo, like ego war. And I think, yeah, definitely a vow of mine to try to shift that culture a little bit back into something a little more respectful.
I studied literature and writing in college, and a huge part of that is getting critiques from your peers. And something that I really clearly remember from a dear friend of mine, Dr. Alan Weltzing, a professor, he said that critiques always feel personal and that they're never personal.
Yeah.
And that both of those things, while at odds with each other, will continue to be true. And as soon as you can believe that in your heart, then you start to love those criticisms.
Totally.
Because it is a great compliment for somebody to give you a criticism, because it's an opportunity to improve at something that you clearly could not see yourself.
Yep.
Right? And what a tremendous gift that is if you can accept it. But you have to get over that feeling of this feels personal. This feels like an attack against me. This, I put everything I had into this. This was my very best effort.
Right.
And it still was wrong. It's like, that's okay.
Yep.
Because now this person who loves you enough that they're willing to take the risk of hurting your feelings,
yeah,
even though that's not how you should be receiving it, they're saying, you can make it even better if you do this. Like, that is awesome. To this day, if I show somebody anything and ask for criticism and they come back and they go, it's good, I liked it, I feel insulted by that.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't. And it's not like feeling insulted in a way that deeply upsets me or anything, but I would much rather that they find something wrong with it, because I can find something wrong with everything.
Right.
I can always look at something and find a way to improve it. And if somebody isn't showing me that same level of analysis, then I feel like they didn't look closely and they don't care.
Yeah, I hear that. But also maybe it was good and you just need to cool it.
There is such a thing as good enough.
Yeah.
There really is such a thing as good enough.
Yeah. I actually kind of struggle with it, because I find myself always being in that mindset of like improve, 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 tweak, 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 improve, improve, because that's been the job for a long time. But I do think it is also like with everything, you need a balance. Mm-hmm. Like it was really hard for me to just, I'm sure for a lot of chefs, to just go out and eat, because yeah, you just always have that brain on. So it's always like, well, that or that or that or that or that, or like home cooked meals or something. It's like not enough salt or this or that. Just like shut up and go sit down and enjoy your friend's company. You know, yeah. It's like you can pick it apart if you want to, but knowing when to turn that off, I think, is like equally as valuable as like when the switch is on. Because then now we're just stuck with like this review culture too, and this like criticism culture, and
which can be really unhealthy as well.
Yeah,
because it can blind you to everything that's good.
Totally. Yeah. When you're in the mode and you're in that moment, and the goal of that moment is to improve, critique, like yeah, flip that switch on and like dive deep. But also sometimes just shut up and eat the under-seasoned potatoes and be really happy somebody cooked for you.
Yeah. Be grateful that you can have potatoes.
Yeah. Be grateful you can have potatoes. So finding that balance, I think, is important for anyone working in restaurants. Otherwise, you're just a snob.
Two more questions.
Yes, sir.
What's the best cocktail to order with a pepperoni pizza?
Great question. I would go old-fashioned probably for no other reason than that sounds nice to me.
It's a great cocktail.
Great cocktail.
Tremendous cocktail. Yeah.
Purely personal preference was like, I would eat a pepperoni pizza in an old-fashioned right now.
Okay. Last question. Where can people enjoy your food today?
M. Crow, Lostine, Oregon.
Okay.
Or come over to my house and I'll make you dinner.
So, yeah. Oh, we're going to have, you know, around or over a million tourists that will drive past M. Crow this summer.
Yep.
And I hope that the correct number of them stop in and get a pizza.
Just enough. Yeah. Just enough.
Or a smash burger.
Yeah. Or a smash burger. We I think about it a lot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hope you like it.
Yeah. Well, I'm confident that they will. And if they don't, Portland's the other way.
keep driving. Just keep on driving.
All right. Thanks, brother. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, man.
I just want to take a second and thank everyone who's written a review, who has sent mail, who has sent emails, who has sent messages. Your support is incredible. And I also love running into you at trade shows and events and just out on the hillside when we're hunting. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you guys keep adventuring as hard and as often as you can. Art for the Six Ranch podcast was created by John Chatelain and was digitized by Celia Harlander. Original music was written and performed by Justin Hay, and the Six Ranch podcast is now produced by Six Ranch Media. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the show, and I look forward to next week when we can bring you a brand new episode.